as a society, as a country, as a global population, we need to be discerning about investing, because if people just view investing as a something where everything goes up, that will eventually end cataclysmically. Because when so much money flows to firms and businesses that just take it and don't give it back, right, which is what a zombie company is and a zombie stock is about, businesses that take money and don't give it back are businesses that burn cash flow. They don't produce any return on the investment that they've been given. Capital allocation means, in theory, you're supposed to take capital from its lowest use to its best use, or from a lower use to a higher use. And by higher use, I mean higher return on investment, or what we call return on invested capital, ROIC. It's what Buffett and all the greats have talked about for years as a key measurement. If that's not happening, then society is suffering. Value is being destroyed, because the money that's supposed to be returned to investors and earning a return and making the pie bigger is instead being siphoned off by Wall Street bankers and executives that are overpaying themselves for running money-losing organizations.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. With the prime rate on debt now over 8%, it is a lot more expensive for companies to borrow today versus recent years. And for the companies so overleveraged that they have to borrow in order to service the interest payments on their existing debt, otherwise known as zombie companies, today's higher rates may well prove fatal. How much longer can these zombie companies hold on before a major die-off wave ensues? And if that indeed happens, what will the repercussions be to the economy and the financial markets? For answers, we're fortunate to welcome back David Trainer, CEO of research firm New Constructs, who's been ringing the warning bell of zombie contagion for a long time now. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, look, really glad to have you back on. I've had a lot of people asking for an update on what's happening with the fleet of zombie companies. A lot of people scratching their heads that rates have gone up extremely, even since you and I last talked. And yet a lot of these companies are still holding on for the most part. So really looking forward to digging into that with you. I know you also have some companies that you're actually quite positive on that you recommend long positions in. So I'd like to squeeze that part of the conversation in too, if we've got time. But before we dive into the details, if I could just do some ground setting here, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
I think, you know, we're walking the razor's edge between, you know, cataclysm and inflation, you know, cataclysmic recession and inflation. And I think that the Fed is, I think that's the path they want to take and in order to sort of please as many people as possible. I mean, look, we live in an increasingly political world, and I think so many times our moves and decisions are based on how do we make sure we don't upset anybody? And I think the Fed is sort of operating under a similar way of thinking. And that means that there's a lot of risk and a lot of opportunity. There's sort of no easy answer. I'm not here to say that the end of the world is near or that we're, you know, about to experience the rapture. I think it's somewhere in between. And exactly where we are in between, I think is hard to really to figure out with a lot of precision. I think people that try to do that or say they're going to do that aren't being as honest as maybe they should be with themselves. And so there's a lot of risk. And we, as you mentioned in the beginning, Adam, there's a lot of zombie stocks. There's also some very attractive stocks. There's opportunity.
All right. Risk and opportunity. Okay. Well, maybe let's tackle it in that order. So let's talk about the risk, specifically the zombie risk that I mentioned there in the intro. I guess first, before I get to the specific questions, can you just refresh our audience on what you, how you and your team at New Constructs define what a zombie company is?
Yeah, sure. So zombie stock is one that we think is going to go to zero because they've got less than 24 months of runway, which means at their current cash burn rate, they've got enough cash on hand to support burning that burn for less than 24 months. Often it's less than, you know, 6 months. They've got effectively a poor business model. So we don't really see there's anything that is going to redeem the business from its cash flow or cash burning ways. And then a negative interest coverage ratio, which means that they don't have enough in pre-tax profit or EBIT to cover their interest costs. So this does not make, this makes the company very unattractive to a new lender in a world where, as you mentioned, cost of borrowing is much higher, and then they're running out of cash. So, you know, it just begs the obvious question, who in their right mind wants to give this company burning cash and can't even afford to pay its current interest rate, right? More money to burn, right? Who's going to chase that rapid, you know, that cash flow down that sort of black hole? And I think it's a fair question for a lot of these companies. And there's around 30 stocks on our list now. And, you know, since we talked, that list has performed extremely well since we last talked about a year ago.
Okay. All right. And sorry, you said 30 stocks on your list. I was going to ask you how many companies right now would you define as a zombie company?
We've got, I think there's around 30 on our list. And you know, it's everything from software businesses to fast casual dining businesses to electric vehicle startups.
Okay. Now I've seen stats out there of let's see here, 300 plus publicly traded companies, or 5 to 10% of all companies could be defined as zombie companies. Is your list of 30 like the worst of the worst, or are you saying that is the universe that fits your definition, your specific definition of less than 24 months burn rate with the negative interest service?
That is my specific definition. So you're right. Okay. There's definitely a sort of more traditional zombie company definition. But that's not what we're talking about. I mean, there's, you know, this term has started to emerge a lot more in the last year since we talked. I think we were among the first to sort of kind of bring it back, you know, because it was really came out of the zombie banks in Japan, I think in the 80s, right? And so we were bringing it back because, you know, what I remember when we talked about a year ago is that we were really kind of at an inflection point in terms of interest rates. It looked as if the Fed was actually really going to raise. And then the market kind of kept calling the Fed's bluff. And until later in the year, when it was clear the Fed was insistent on raising rates meaningfully and consistently. As soon as we believed that was going to happen, we started putting together this zombie stock list, because we just have seen so many of these businesses that some of them came out in the IPO boom in 2020, but you know, should never have been born, and really had a hard time justifying their existence. Adam, you know, when you're losing that much money, in a lot of cases the valuations on those stocks were still extremely high. And you're now entering an environment where it's really difficult to get new capital, or much more expensive, and yet you already can't afford to pay your current interest payments. You know, it's just a bad position to be in.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. So there's probably a wider, you know, looking at the trade media and whatnot, there's probably a wider description of zombie companies in terms of companies that have to borrow to, you know, pay their service, their debt service. Not all of them necessarily are going to go to zero, but it sounds like the list that you guys curate there at New Constructs, that's the Deadpool, right? That's where you say these guys are all on a timer. We think they're all going to zero. We're watching these guys really closely. Let's talk for a moment about, because I've got a lot of questions about the repercussions of what will happen when these companies fail. But I guess, you know, you mentioned that on your list, you've got companies that are still richly valued, given what you think their prospects are here. And I know there are a lot of people that are, you know, either have dismissed the zombie risk because they're like, well, we've had, you know, the Fed's done nothing but raise rates for the past year, and these companies are holding in there. So what's the big deal, right? It's sort of that fallacy of if it hasn't happened yet, it's not going to happen, right? So what has kept these zombies from just going to zero so far? Is it that they did successful capital raises early on enough that they're still sitting on, you know, cheap debt, and it just hasn't rolled over yet and had to be refinanced, or are there other reasons?
For a lot of them, there have been major layoffs. So they've cut costs significantly and reduced their cash burn. Peloton in particular has done that. Robinhood has done that.
Sorry to interrupt, but so they're still bleeding out, but they've reduced the speed of the bleeding.
Yes, exactly. They've reduced the bleed. They've reduced the, the pace of dying, or yes, they're dying more slowly. But yes, that's been a big part of it. I think some of them have been able to successfully restructure some of their debt, right? And then, you know, there's an incentive for the existing debt holders to say, okay, listen, we know you can't do it at this certain rate, so, you know, we'll try to figure out another deal for you. I think that's happened with Carvana. With, you know, they've got a fair amount of kind of cars or hard assets on the books. It maybe helps with that. But in many ways, I think it's just delaying the inevitable. And I think you bring up a great point, Adam, that there's a lot of people that believe, oh, just because, it, you know, if it hasn't happened yet, it's not going to happen. I mean, that has been the sort of philosophy of a lot of, I think, reckless investing over the last 10 to 20 years. And it's getting worse, not better. And just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it isn't going to happen with these businesses, barring some drastic turnaround in how they do business.
Right, right. Okay. And just for to make it clear for folks of why a lender would be willing to revise its lending terms for these struggling companies, it's basically just math, folks, right? It's like, well, hey, we'd much rather get 50% of our investment back than 0% of it back. So let's see if we can help this company, you know, stay alive, and maybe it ups its game at some point in the future, and, you know, we're able to get paid back at least something, you know, on this loan that we've made. You're nodding as I'm saying this. All right. So, you know, I did talk about the fact that some of these companies, you know, have they did raise capital back when it was a lot cheaper a year ago than it is now, right? We've had, like I said, prime is now above 8% here. I mean, if you've got a prime plus one loan, which probably a lot of these companies couldn't even get at this point, given their dire situation, that's still nine something. I mean, that's just an incredibly high cost of debt versus what you could get a year ago. You know, at some point, these companies that are, you know, basically meeting their expenses with the cash they raised previously, they are going to have to go out there and try to take on more debt. And if they can get it from a lender, it's going to be at probably a pretty staggeringly high rate. I was talking with, I think it was Michael Green the other day. I think this was Ted Oakley. He said that, you know, he was saying that he sees a maturity wall coming in like 2024, 2025, where he wasn't talking specifically about zombie companies. He was just talking about sort of all levered corporate entities out there, that there's going to be a big impact from when those companies have to go and refinance. A lot of them, they're going to have to start cutting costs by doing their own layoffs and whatnot. They're not necessarily zombies, but I imagine this could be something more of like a silver bullet for some of those zombies on your list, where it could just kind of be the thing that finally kills them dead at that point in time, or at least rips the bandages off and the hemorrhaging starts, you know, at full pace and new. So do you see, are you looking at some sort of maturity cliff like this too at some point in the future?
You know, I wonder if you said Michael Green.
I'm pretty sure it was Michael Green. I had this conversation with you.
Yeah, I wonder if that cliff is maybe a little bit more geared toward commercial real estate, because I do, from what I remember, there are a lot of commercial mortgage-backed securities, and I think a lot of lending that kind of comes in waves. And I think I've talked to some folks that had similar things about a cliff in terms of maturities in that area. I think there's also a big cliff in terms of federal maturities and treasuries. I think on the individual company level, it's harder to say, Adam, because everybody's negotiating their own sort of debt deal. So I don't know that it's as comparable or as easy to say there's a particular cliff that's going to affect a lot of individual companies, because they tend to, you know, they issue or take bank debt, issue debt to investors or take bank debt on different terms with different kinds of maturities.
Well, let me maybe say then, or ask then, could this be more sort of like a rolling thunder that builds in crescendo as time goes on, which is just that as these guys have to recapitalize, no matter how they're getting it, it's coming at a higher expense than what they had before.
That's exactly right. I agree completely. That's exactly what we've been sort of thinking about and talking about with these zombie stocks. It's like, listen, they were able to stay alive because people were willing to throw good money after bad because it was so cheap. And as the environment shifts, banks and other lenders and investors are going to be less willing to lend money and throw good money after bad. And I think you bring up a great point there, Adam, in terms of, you know, in the question about a cliff. And I think what the Fed is trying to do is avoid the emergence of cliffs and to do this as gradually as possible so that it doesn't have a major impact and kind of suck everything down with it. In my hopeful nature, I like to believe that Fed Chair Powell's real goal here is to break the cycle. His legacy, his goal for his legacy is to break the cycle of kind of volatility that the prior Fed chairman have overseen, which is markets and the economy gets a little bit out of hand and they come in, they squash it, things take a nosedive, and then it's right back off to the races. And that's not really been that healthy. In fact, it has engendered this buy the dip mentality that means people don't really even see or feel the punishment they're supposed to feel by a rate rise and a recession. And it's not so much that people need to feel punishment, Adam. That's not really what I'm trying to say. They don't need to feel losses. But what they do need to learn is how to be discerning between good investments and bad investments. And when all your investments work, you don't learn that a good investment is different from a bad investment because right. Things just keep going up. And as a society, as a country, as a global population, we need to be discerning about investing because if people just view investing as something where everything goes up, that will eventually end cataclysmically. Because when so much money flows to firms and businesses that just take it and don't give it back, right, which is what a zombie company is and a zombie stock is about, businesses that take money and don't give it back are businesses that burn cash flow. They don't produce any return on the investment that they've been given. The reason standards of living go up around the world, and in particular the United States, is because we have the best capital allocation mechanism in a stock market before anyone else. And what that means is that capital allocation means, in theory, you're supposed to take capital from its lowest use to its best use, or from a lower use to a higher use. And by higher use, I mean higher return on investment, or what we call return on invested capital, ROIC. It's what Buffett and all the greats have talked about for years as a key measurement. If that's not happening, then society is suffering. Value is being destroyed because the money that's supposed to be returned to investors and earning a return and making the pie bigger is instead being siphoned off by Wall Street bankers and executives that are overpaying themselves for running money-losing organizations.
Well, look, in many ways, from your lips to God's ears, you know, if we can return to that type of environment where, you know, the dead wood gets cold and the capital flows efficiently to the best investments that are out there, I think we have had, our capital allocation mechanism has been compromised, I think, over the past couple of decades, largely due to a lot of intervention, honestly, on behalf of the central planners, especially the central banks. Which has enabled a lot of these, value destroying companies to persist because folks have been able to sort of speculate on asset prices. And that has sort of been, you know, a very big driver of returns in this market, if you will, for the investor, right? But it's sort of this false sense of prosperity because it's really, you know, just shifting capital around based upon where people think it should be, as opposed to where the fundamentals say it should be. And what's interesting is, you know, that's the role of a recession. That is the natural role of a recession, right? Is to clear out this deadwood so that the capital then flows to the better models that are out there. That very well may be where Powell's trying to go. I think there's been a lot of debate, you know, over the past year, at least over Powell's tenure, as to whether he's a different animal than his predecessors or not. And I would say he's probably given plenty of evidence on both sides of that argument in his tenure. But he does seem right now to be speaking, you know, like he's playing for legacy here and that he's the guy that wants to try to restore some sustainability to the system. We'll see if that happens or not. But what's interesting is, you know, if he is trying to sort of just gradually, you know, fine tune the dials here to try to engineer the softest landing he can here, maybe that's what plays out. Maybe that's what his strategy is. But A couple of things. One, as they continue to you know bring rates up, you get to a critical threshold where companies just can't sustain that type of cost of capital. And we may even be beyond that point in time. You know, like I said, these companies may be just able to survive for as long as they have because they had enough cash reserves, or they're sitting on, you know, capital that they raised at a much lower rate. But, you know, once those cash reserves run out or once they have to go and refinance and it's a much higher level, I think you get to the sort of exponential, you know, sort of Hemingway-esque type of reckoning here where, you know, how'd you go broke? Well, slowly and then all at once. You know, I think, and you're nodding as I'm saying this, but don't let me put words in your mouth, that this cohort, especially the 30 that you're looking at, they will probably, you know, you start losing one or two or three over time, but then you're going to get to a point where a bunch of them start going down at the same time because we've just passed that critical threshold. I'll let you respond to that in just one second, but I'll add one more thought here, which is, you know, Powell may be trying to fine-tune all this, but from his public statements, you know, he has said essentially, look, I'm not that worried about overcorrecting here. Because he said we have the tools to come in and stimulate the economy. We kind of know how to do that. And that's why I'm really erring on the side of doing whatever it takes, higher for longer, whatever, to kill the inflation monster, because that's a harder beast for us as central planners to deal with. If the economy really starts struggling, you know, from the austere measures that we use to bring inflation down, we kind of know how to jolt that patient back to life. Now, we can argue whether we think they can do that well or we agree with those tactics, but I think that's his mindset here. So I kind of think that Powell, given all that background, I think he'd be kind of happy if the worst of the zombie companies died off here. I think he would say, hey, that's part of the excess that we just need to get rid of the system to try to right size this a little bit more and bring a little bit more sort of healthy sustainability back into things. So anyways, I'll let you respond to any or all of that as you like.
I agree 100%. I think the Fed would love to be as surgical as possible with cutting out sort of the dead wood, as you say, right? And that's the goal, so that they can cut out as much dead wood without sacrificing any of the green wood or the good companies. And so I think what the predecessors have sort of done before has been a lot less surgical, been a lot more blunt. And we've seen kind of everything flush with a big market crash, right? And I think that's what really he's trying to avoid. And I think that part of that is for sure to be a little bit maybe more dovish in terms of the way they raise rates, which they certainly, everyone felt like they were too late to the party, right? And they got a lot of criticism for that, been a little more aggressive. But on the margin, you know, I feel like he's been very reactive to markets in terms of like slowing down the rate rises or putting them off and delaying. And I believe all of this, Adam, is in an effort to be more surgical, but also I think recognize that it doesn't all have to happen at once. Doesn't need to all happen at once. In fact, if it does happen gradually, and we see the zombies, and they don't all die at once, they die off one at a time, right? That the longer this takes, the better chance he has at making changes to behavior over the long term. And in particular, what I'm talking about with behavior is discerning and discernment between good and bad investments. As long as people think that buy the dip is a foolproof strategy, they'll never be discerning. They'll just think a stock going down is a reason to buy, whether it's got good fundamentals or not. But if over the long term, the bad investments just stop producing and then eventually die, and this happens over, I don't know, months and years, we're in a much better place for potentially changing the bad behaviors that I think that have emerged and become so cemented and part of the way people invest today. And hopefully that leads to much that leads to a much better and more efficient market and economy for the long term.
Okay, well, that's actually a pretty optimistic outlook. Do you think that we are on that path, on that trajectory? And if we are, I'm like you, I guess it would probably really take years before we migrated to
You know, I can
more of
only
that
hope.
better place.
Yeah, Adam, I can only hope, right? Like as you said before, from my lips to God's ears, like I don't want to be naive. I hope that that's what Powell's thinking and doing, because I think that is what we need. Like having lived through the 97 crash, the tech bubble, the financial crisis, and really have just seen why people have good reason to have been habituated to this. Oh my gosh, as soon as there's a crash, I'm going to buy the dip. And not really thinking about, oh, the purpose of this recession was to clear out the dead wood and clear out the investors who throw capital after dead wood because they're bad allocators. We got malinvestment from that kind of mentality. And I think that in order for that to stick this time around, it's got to be something that people feel pain for a long time. They got to know every time they touch the hot stove, they're going to get burned, and they're going to have to get burned multiple times, I think. But over a long period of time as well.
Okay. So one of the things that's been a hallmark of, I would say, the policies that led to the current situation that we're in has been because the central banks kind of created this ever rising tide and were always there to step in to backstop the market. We had the rise of all these passive investing vehicles because they were easy and they worked, right? They worked in that environment. It sounds like what you're predicting here is that, or at least hoping for here, is probably a return to a more active form of investing, right? Where you're really going to have to crack open the fundamentals of the companies that you invest in and really figure them out. To your point there, you can't just say, oh, the price is down, ergo, it's good to buy now, right? You're really going to have to say, okay, look, yeah, the price might be down by 30%, but it's still a good value at this point. I got to figure that out. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, I think that's a big part of it. People have to relearn why they should focus on fundamentals. I agree with you 100%. A lot of bad habits. I mean, the meme stocks are just like the greatest example ever of just really bad investment behavior. Bored Apes like takes it to a whole new level. I mean, this is, I think, you know, I hope that Fed Chair Powell and all the central planners for that matter see this as a sign of just how much people have perverted, in their minds at least, the purpose of the capital markets. And going back to, again, the goal of the capital markets is to allocate capital to its highest and best use. If we do that, right, we continue to innovate, we continue to grow, the pie gets bigger. And when people are trading simply just to make short-term profits without any regard to underlying fundamentals, that's when capital goes to bad businesses and we see the pie get smaller. And when that happens, we end up in like a third world country eventually, right? Where we can't even afford to keep the lights on. The electric grid can't be, basic infrastructure can't be maintained. And people, you know, poverty levels go way higher and the ability to bail people out goes away because the government's broke too. And so, you know, I that's my goal, right? I mean, that's my hope. That would be my goal if I were a central planner. What is in Fed Chair Powell's brain, I have no idea. And this is just me looking to find kind of, you know, the best path or what the optimal path would be so I can continue to be an optimist.
Okay. I'm veering off of zombies here for a second. I will come back to them in just a moment. So one of the things that I think is a challenge to transitioning back to a more active approach to investing, and I'm talking for the markets at large here, is that we have all of these, this is sort of what Michael Green calls and Bill Fleckenstein called the giant mindless robot, right? Which is that so many of the ETFs today are like algorithmic, where they have to, they're basically, their capital allocation is done just basically, you know, by an algo, right? That says, okay, we're going to put money into, you know, these stocks. And they tend to be market cap weighted. Something like 37 cents or something last time I saw it of any, every new dollar that goes in the market goes into like these top eight stocks that are powering the market right now. I mean, they're responsible for pretty much almost all of the gain in the S&P this year is just this small cohort of stocks. And they've got this unfair advantage where, again, any bit of new capital that goes in the market goes disproportionately into them because they're over-owned or they're so heavily owned in all these ETFs that just have a mathematical formula they follow for new money coming in here. So it almost sort of creates this self-perpetuating cycle. So I'm just trying to think, how would we evolve from what we have right now to something where active management really could be fully free and fully unfettered? And I'm guessing it's either a proactive changing of the algos that drive, these big ETFs, and or it just could be that the losses are going to have to be, something's going to happen to start making these things take big losses, such to the point where investors demand a different approach. But I'm curious what your thoughts might be.
I think this is all tied into our prior line of discussion, right? I think until markets become a bit more rational and discerning, people can get away with being undiscerning or even irrational. And and look, the passive stuff tends to work so well because there is no real rhyme or reason for what's going to happen with a lot of these other stocks. And as long as you're chasing momentum, that's been sort of the one rhyme and reason that has worked, is momentum, FOMO, YOLO, this kind of mentality. And I think that's conducive to the passive, because that means either you're going to be wildly out on the risk spectrum or you're going to be on the other end. Because in between, which is where I think the active manager lives, has not really worked, because there is sort of nothing really related to fundamentals and being strategic about long and short that has been that successful over most of the last 20 years. So I think it's related. I also think that, as the Fed continues to squeeze out sort of the excesses, people will be forced to come back to fundamentals, because the math is very simple, as I put it before. Like, if you're going to be investing a dollar and you get 50 cents back, that can't be sustained, right? That ultimately leads to destruction. You invest a dollar, you get a dollar 50 back, that's sustainable. And that's really how the invisible hand is supposed to work. And that means fundamentals are what matters. And so I think a couple of things are going to happen on this front. Number one, the sort of return to fundamentals, Adam. But I also feel like advances in technology are going to make reliable fundamental research more accessible. Part of the reason why Wall Street's been able to prey on the unsuspecting self-directed investors as successfully as it has is because, what options do these self-directed investors have? What options do wirehouse and RIA advisors have besides Wall Street research? Not much. Who's going out there and actually doing the diligence and looking through the footnotes and doing the dirty work that nobody wants to do? Who even cares to do it when YOLO, FOMO, and meme stocks are the rage, right? And a lot of times it doesn't pay. Shoot, it didn't pay back when I was on Wall Street at Credit Suisse during the tech bubble, right? And I would go talk to analysts and talk about their analytical methods and say, hey, so what do you think about this working capital advantage that this business has? Because they got negative working capital. They'd say, what? What's working capital? Like, well, don't you look at the balance sheet? And they're like, I got an IPO. It's going to make us $1 billion coming out next week. Why am I
Right,
going to look at
right.
the balance sheet? And so the people that are supposed to be doing the work aren't really doing the work. And I think leadership has to emerge that's going to do this kind of work and make it available to people, so that even if they want to do fundamental research today, they can't. And if that research becomes available and even used by some of the larger firms and advocated by larger firms, well, then I think that's going to help. Because in as much as people might want to be rational and intelligent investors, and index funds could be designed in a way that have more rational capital allocation strategies baked into the algorithm besides just chasing momentum, right? Then I think there's an opportunity for fundamentals to matter again. Without that resource, it's very difficult. And without that resource, it's very easy for the narrative-driven investment strategies that Wall Street propagates to continue to dominate.
So super interesting. And I'm trying to separate this from the enthusiasm, some might say excessive euphoria, that's going on in the markets right now regarding artificial intelligence. But it sounds like this is something artificial intelligence could play a big role in, because it's really all about culling and then processing and curating information in a way to help make better decisions, which, as I understand AI, and for the folks that didn't watch it, I did a video a couple of days ago on this channel with Dylan Patel, just trying to give sort of a layman's explanation about this current AI wave and what we can expect from it, and maybe what's hype and what's real. It's a very interesting, I thought, very useful discussion. If you want to go watch that after this video, I'll put up a link to it right here. But I'm just curious, David, when you say that, hey, we might start having some alternatives to the Wall Street research houses, Are you thinking of just a different set of people doing this, or are these organizations that will be using AI to provide this disruption?
Yeah, there's already a lot of independent research firms and different people doing research that have been out for a while. But yeah, now I am talking about machine learning and AI. And I use the term AI like very carefully, because I don't really believe that there's any true artificial intelligence these days, Adam, because to me, intelligence requires sentience more than just repeating patterns or recombining existing patterns. I think that's what machine learning is. And I think there's a lot of value in that. But semantics aside, yes, I think advances in technology in particular are going to be critical to doing the kind of in-depth research that I will tell you, professional investors, sophisticated professional investors don't want to do and don't believe they have time to do, but is absolutely essential to the capital markets. There's a Harvard Business School and MIT Sloan paper that proves that the markets do not impound footnotes in financial filings, right? Because nobody's looking at it. That paper was published a couple of years ago. There have been studies with alpha trading strategies that use footnotes information that demonstrate that the markets don't take into account the footnotes information for at least 23 days to a month after it's published, right? And who knows if that's just because the invisible hand is working or because enough people have had a chance to read the footnotes, right? So we need machines to do this work desperately because no one is doing it right now. And as long as no one is doing that, companies can continue to meaningfully manipulate earnings. And so, yes, and I think that the key difference that I want to make sure people know to draw between machine learning, AI, hocus pocus, and real machine learning and AI, is that the real stuff is based on what expert humans have taught a machine. Machines aren't going to go in and be able to figure out how to read footnotes on their own. Machines don't do anything that humans don't teach them to do, Adam, right? And I think what we're seeing these days with ChatGPT, it's been very smart and taught well how to recombine a bunch of information that's free out there on the internet. But when we're talking about footnotes, when really no one has ever decoded footnotes before, it's going to take someone fastidiously going through all these footnotes and having humans make these distinctions between the, you know, the nuanced line items that look the same from an accounting perspective, but mean different things from an economic perspective, right? And vice versa, accounting items that look different, but mean the same thing in terms of their underlying economic consequence. Until someone can train a machine to do that at scale, it's not gonna happen. But when that does happen, well, that's real machine learning, right? That's taking expertise that's capable to come only from a human at this point, putting it into a machine and now achieving some real scale. And that to me is much closer to most of the AI or real AI than what's out there today. When that happens, right, now we're going to be able to have a source of fundamental research that's truly complete and comprehensive that I think is going to be even better than what humans can do. Because if you've got an army of humans doing the same thing in footnotes, Adam, you can't trust that they're all doing it the same way. And as important as it is to get the good stuff out of the footnotes, it's also important that that stuff is treated consistently. Because if we don't have apples to apples comparisons between companies, we can't properly discern which business models are better than the other. So that's a pretty long-winded answer. The answer is yes. And I think it's more of an AI machine learning. There's more to it than what most people realize.
All right. That's a great point. And I say that as someone who started his career as an investment banking analyst on Wall Street, where I spent way more all-nighters than I care to remember, culling through financial statements, and most of the time it's crawling through the tiny text of all the footnotes, because it's not nearly as egregious as it wasn't nearly as egregious as it is today. But companies would report what they had to report from GAAP accounting requirements. But then, you know, there are all these little tricks and strategies about how you can, basically divulge all the things you need to divulge, but you're doing it in little, obscure parts of the, 200 page 10K, where you're just, revealing it as vaguely as you can in the footnotes. And that's where the real analysis goes in, is crawling through those footnotes and really trying to reconstitute what the true picture of this company is, and really trying to see the things that management doesn't really want you to be able to see easily, right? So I totally get what you're talking about there. And I do think that that'll be really transformative if we get indeed that type of machine learning that does that. And just for full disclosure, in talking about this with Dylan Patel about, you know, AIs, he says, look, yeah, current AI, what we're talking about here, you know, that's got all the headlines right now, he's like, it's not intelligence, right? It's not a sentient, conscious intelligence. It's just brute force, but it's brute force at this massive scale that we've never had before. And that scale keeps increasing exponentially. But it's really a garbage in, garbage out, you know, type of system. So you have to make sure that the inputs you're putting in are as clean as possible. And then, to your point, you can then train the software to, you know, recognize certain patterns. And, you know, you basically give it a rule set that then improves its ability to, you know, do a lot of the type of refining work that you're talking about here. So it'll be interesting to see what the future brings here. But if we end up getting what you're predicting here, I totally agree that it'll be transformative. All right, I want to get back to zombies real quick, because then I want to get to some of the areas of the market that you're more sanguine on. I guess if we end up getting a culling of the zombie companies, let's say you're 30, you know, your list of 30 all die, and a lot of the other compromised companies out there, the 5 to 10% of all companies, the stat that I mentioned at the beginning, let's say they go into retrenchment mode and they, you know, are forced to downsize enough so that they're no longer just cash flow burners, right? But that's probably going to be, you know, we're going to see some huge declines in performance in those companies. We're probably going to see a bunch of layoffs, et cetera. How big is the impact of that going to be on the economy and the markets? Is it something that you worry about in terms of, you know, how it could slow economic growth or bring the markets down with it? Or is this such a gangrenous part of the market that we don't really have to worry that much if it dries up and falls off the body?
Well, I think that's part of why the Fed's got to be so surgical and wants to be gradual, because I do think it's a large part of the economy. I think it's a large part of the stock market. I think there's a lot of fast money, silly money in the market, and it's a big part of it. And it can turn negative and bearish in mass very quickly, and that would be damaging and potentially somewhat kind of cataclysmic. And so I think there's a lot of dead wood to be cleared out, Adam, and that's part of why the Fed wants to go about doing it gradually, because if it does it all at once, then we have a major market crash, recession, disenchantment, you know, all the things that we kind of don't want, that, you know, what we call the, you know, during the great financial depression or whatever it was called last time. And then the Fed's got to come back in and save the day, and then things kind of go back to where they were. That's part of my sort of thesis here around why the Fed needs to go slowly, gradually. Let's cut the deadwood out as surgically as we can, which happens much better when you do it slowly, deliberately, carefully, and then go get at it, stay at it for a long period of time, a long enough period of time that the people that believed in just buy the dip are sort of disattached or unattached from those beliefs. They don't believe that, oh, I can just buy the dip. Oh, this was a bad company and it's not going to come back. I should have been more careful on the front end. And these are things that are just going to take a long time. And I think it's better if it does take a long time, because that's the only way to change behavior.
All right. So let me push you to prognosticate here. So I totally get that if the Fed pursues that prolonged surgical strategy, that's probably its best bet of threading the needle and changing investors' mindsets over time. There's a difference, though, between what the Fed hopes to do and what the Fed actually engineers. And I will say the Fed doesn't have a great track record of delivering upon what it forecasts. So what kind of probability do you give to this threading of the needle that you're talking about versus, despite its best intentions, things go off the rails beforehand?
You know, that's a great question. And that's the $1 trillion question. You know, I'm going to say 60-40 in favor. And here's why. In our political environment, anything that could be deemed as too aggressive and harmful is going to get a lot of blowback, right? No politicians want to be on record or in office as have been the ones who sort of created the stock market meltdown, the great reckoning, the great reset that we hear folks like Stanley Druckenmiller talk about and other major investors that are really pointing to what I've been talking about, all this deadwood, all this bad behavior, all these misaligned incentives. And so they're all bad for sure. But at the end of the day, if we make people feel too much pain, they're gonna revolt, and the Fed's gonna have to slow it down. So I think in many ways, Fed's backed into a corner, but maybe that's a better way, because they'll be forced to go slowly and gradually. And so it's not so much that I believe necessarily that they've got to figure it out. That's what they want to do. It's kind of that they've also kind of have to do it.
All right. Well, look, I'm gonna hope that you're right, that the majority of the probability is in the Fed's corner here. I will say I do worry about the lag effect that we may have tightened so aggressively, so quickly. And then you layer on top of that things like the additional bank lending tightening that's happened post the fragility in the banking sector, which Powell has admitted acts like additional rate hikes, that there's the impact of Fed policy acts on a time delay. That's the lag effect, right? And so we may have a number of shockwaves that were started a year or so ago, but haven't quite hit the economy yet. And they may just start slamming into the economy, and we can't do anything to stop them because they were put in motion, in the past. So I do worry about the lag effect here, but in the short term, I'm going to hope that you're right. All right, well, let me ask one last question on the zombies, and then we'll get to the long side of your outlook. Are there prudent ways to investors to play this expectation of the die-off of the zombies here? Is shorting a good and viable strategy here for the retail investor? Or is it squishy and unreliable enough that maybe just given the fact that you can park in safety and get paid nicely for it right now, maybe it's just better doing that, waiting for the bad companies to die off, maybe the market gets hit a little bit, and then you can deploy at better valuations and at better companies. I'm just curious on your thoughts there.
I think shorting is dangerous. And I love an old sales partner of mine, loved to quote Ben Hogan, who said, my golf game is not so much about how many good shots I hit, it's about how many bad shots I don't hit. Mm-hmm. Right. And so think about the zombie stock list as much as a list of stocks to avoid. Same with our most dangerous stocks list. Don't buy them. If you got them, sell them. Shorting, it's tough because you've got so many crosswinds. I mean, look, I've run a hedge fund and I've been right about a lot of shorts, but lost a lot of money on those same shorts.
Right. Because timing is so key in that space, much more so than on the long, right?
Yeah, it's crazy, especially in a world where you've got the Bored Apes who are potentially going to shove, push a bad stock up. I mean, you just got to be careful. And it's been going on for a long time in that way. And so, yeah, I'm not naive enough to say, it's a zombie stock, it's going to go to zero. Well, the big question is when. And if it goes up at 50% in the meantime, you're going to get crushed by shorting. So I just say, look, just understand risk reward. That's all I want. That's my biggest piece of advice to investors in general. Understand risk reward, and zombie stock risk reward is really bad. So just, stay away.
All right. Okay. We'll get to this at the end of the conversation, but I'll give you a chance to preview it here. So if folks want to find your list of these stocks, where do they go?
Go to newconstructs.com. And you can get access to all of our research and offerings there.
Okay, great. All right. Now shifting to, again, the more optimistic side of things. Now, you've said that there are some companies here that are catching your attention. So love to hear why they're catching your attention. And if you feel comfortable sharing a name or two, explaining sort of, as emblematic of the companies you're excited about, please do.
Yeah, I'm kind of a believer that we're way back, we're moving way more into a stock pickers kind of market. So there are what we call micro bubbles, right? A micro bubbles where you've got some super overvalued stocks, and those are the zombie stocks. And then there's a lot of attractive stocks as well. I think if you look alternatively from the overpriced EV startups, and some of those are going out of business. I think a bunch of them have already gone out of business, and more will go out of business. But GM and Ford are sitting there generating huge amounts of cash flow. GM with a great return on capital, and it's extremely cheap priced as if profits are going to permanently decline by 40 or 50%, right? Where the prices for the EV makers like Rivian and Tesla, their prices, if they're going to have, you know, ungodly amounts of market share in the future. So you've got bad risk reward and good risk reward there. I think in general, from a sector level, basic materials, energy, and financials present a lot of stocks with great opportunities, because so much capital's flowed out of, you know, like say basic materials. People forgot like what makes a country and a world work. We're so focused on AI and the cloud and things, you know, intellectual and intangible, that we forgot that, you know, sometimes we just got to make some steel. And you got to, you know, you need steel to build turbines. You need steel to build solar panels. So, you know, as green as you want to be, you still need steel to build these things.
Is that sector set to benefit from the infrastructure funds that are being spent with the Inflation Reduction Act right now?
In a huge way. Right. And, you know, in particular, Nucor Steel Dynamics trading as if profits will permanently decline by 40, 50%. Right. Super cheap, super strong cash flow, and setting up for a world where the demand for steel is going to be very steady and strong for a long time.
Okay, great. All right. So I interrupted you there on basic materials. How about energy and financials? What about those sectors? Have your
attention? You know, energy is kind of a similar thing and a similar theme, I think, with respect to sort of basic materials, and that, you know, everyone has sort of been predicting the demise of fossil fuels and the energy sector for a long time. And the bottom line is that the demand for energy around the world is growing faster than the alternative energy sources can come online. So fossil fuel demand is actually not expected to go down over the next 50 years by much at all. And these stocks are priced as if profits, again, are going to decline by 40, 50%. And this is from the IEA, right, the International Energy Association, and for multiple folks. I think the Aspen Ideas Festival and a few weeks ago, or even earlier this week, the CEO of BP, you know, made the same point. Look, you know, we are investing in alternative energies and we are trying to be as environmentally friendly as possible. But the idea that fossil fuels are going away is just not true.
It's not true. And just to let you know, I've had energy experts on this channel in the past where we have talked about this, and it's just the math. It's not a philosophical issue with alternatives. I think everybody pretty much, you know, thinks we should be having as many renewable energy sources as we can economically get. But they just, in the next couple of decades, at least, there's no way that they can replace a material amount of the energy that we get from fossil fuels. And so even for the most, you know, optimistic people who want to make the energy transition off of fossil fuels, anybody who works in the energy space has to be realistic about how the math works out here. So totally get what you're saying. And as a little preview, folks, Art Berman, oil expert, should be coming on this channel in the next week or so. I'm still working out of time with him, but hopefully he can come on and we'll be digging deeply into exactly this topic, David.
Right. Yeah, no, it is just math. And that's my philosophy in all of our research. I want to go where the math makes sense, and a lot of sense. And that's sort of our long ideas in basic materials, financials, and energy. You know, we're seeing stocks that are just where the math is presenting such great risk reward, strong cash flow, super cheap valuation, the opposite of some of these high flying stocks, the zombie stocks we're talking about, where the math doesn't work, losing tons of money, super expensive valuation. It just makes no sense from risk reward. And hoping people can see that sooner themselves too.
So talk to me about financials. So they haven't performed all that great. We've certainly seen the stresses in the banking system recently. You know, if you're not one of the top like five banks in the US, you've had a pretty rough go, as you know, many of those companies have been underwater in a lot of their longer term what were safe assets and still are to a certain extent, but they're because of the loan duration. They're having real balance sheet problems right now. They're having a lot of capital flight as depositors are taking their money out because they can get a much higher return in, you know, a money market fund or just T-bills. You know, a lot of the smaller banks, and by that I mean like, you know, any bank that's not in the top 10, tend to have a disproportionately higher exposure to commercial real estate, which is looked at as a sector right now that has got even, you know, worse days ahead of it. Talk to me about what catalysts you think are going to turn that sector around.
Well, I'm with you on the commercial real estate front. You know, I think if folks have made a lot of have a lot of exposure to that, then they'd kind of deserve to go out of business. If they've mismanaged their balance sheet in the way that Silicon Valley Bank and other banks, then they deserve to go out of business. And those were zombies, right, that deserve to die effectively. And there's, you know, you go back to just sort of, you know, how the regulators didn't do their job with Silicon Valley Bank and some of these other firms that just had really bad mismatches on their balance sheet. As one of my buddies said it, they failed banking 101. And that's some good examples of some the gradual die-off of some zombies. So, I'll take a little victory lap there, right? There's more to come, but those are a couple of zombies. And I think you got to, you know, this is all about separating the wheat from the chaff, Adam. This is where it comes back to being discerning, right? You don't just go put your money in a mid-cap bank ETF and hope it's all going to come out right because they're all cheap. No, go roll up your sleeves, do your work, and find the right stocks, right? And so, for example, you know, we kind of a couple of stocks we put on our focus list, Discover Financial Services and Zions Bancorp. You know, we went in, did some work, and we said, you know what? The underwriting here is actually really strong. We're seeing counter cyclical trends in terms of delinquencies and charge-offs at these banks that mean that the credit quality and their balance sheets are much stronger than they're being given credit for. Oh, and by the way, Zions was very, very clear for a long time to avoid commercial real estate in its underwriting. Going back a couple of years ago. So, you know, and then yet their trading is cheap as a lot of these other stocks. I think the Zions Bancorp, when we first put it on our focus list, was trading as if profits were going to decline by like 70, 80% or something, right? And Discover was trading it at something pretty similar. And so Discover's really been a big, big winner for us so far. Zions is still, I think, lagging a bit. But yeah, you got to roll your sleeves up. You know, Schwab is another one, not super cheap. Probably going to have to raise some capital because its ratios aren't so great. We'll see, but a great business, a leading business that we think has a lot of upside because it got so cheap. JP Morgan, you know, I've been saying for years, that's better than an index fund because index funds these days, right? They're blindly run, all these ETFs, we were just talking about that before, and they've taken on a lot of junk. They've been chasing a lot of momentum, especially the market weighted ones. And that there's just, they're not as intelligently run as I think a JP Morgan is. And I base that based on super high returns on capital, huge cash flow, and again, a cheap valuation. I think the beta for JP Morgan is going to be better than the beta for the S&P 500. So that's my thinking on financials. And in general, as a sector too, Adam, you know, it's seen a huge decline over the last quarter century in terms of its composition in the S&P 500. So I think it's time for a bit of a comeback to some of the old school stocks as people have been fascinated and run away and carried away by all the narratives on the AI and cloud and whatever fad you want to have stocks.
All right. So sorry, just on that last point there, it sounds like you're talking more sort of about capital rotation, right? Whereas if we get to a point where capital starts to feel like, all right, the money's been made in these high-flying sectors, I need to go to the next place where there's opportunity. You think it'll flow into some of these sectors here?
You know, capital rotation is what I'm hoping the Fed is trying to engender as well, right? Capital circulating away from the deadwood or the overpriced to the underpriced or the greenwood. It's the same kind of idea. It all fits together. It's just something that you know, I think can happen. Should happen, and you know, let's pray that it does happen. Otherwise, you know, we're going to end up like a third world country.
All right, and we've talked a lot on this program recently about the importance of liquidity, and in the fact that maybe it's been driving asset prices higher for longer than most people who were worried about the recessions and a lot of the scary macro data have thought possible. And oftentimes, you know, we just have to remind people: look, the market doesn't care what you think should happen. You know, you just have to be cognizant of what is happening in the market. And as long as there's a lot of liquidity sloshing around there, where that liquidity goes is really important. So to your point, if you see that liquidity, you know, beginning to slosh more into some of these currently unloved sectors, yeah, it's gonna create rising tides in those sectors. All right. Well, look, we're getting close here on time. I do recall when we were sort of setting up this conversation, you mentioned something about the fact that your firm, New Constructs, is setting up some ETFs with Bloomberg. Could you just give me a little bit more detail about that?
Yeah. Same little shameless self-promotion here, if you don't mind, and you can cut that part out if you want. But yes, no, we partnered with Bloomberg to launch a family of ETFs. The first one's going to be called the True Earnings Index. And that's based on our measure of core earnings, which has been proven by multiple papers to produce idiosyncratic alpha, because it actually is based on a truer measure of profits that accounts for all the unusual gains and losses that companies like to bury in footnotes. And so we've built some technology to go through and do that machine learning I talked about before, produce a truer number. And multiple papers have proven that core earnings can generate idiosyncratic alpha. And Bloomberg's going to launch an ETF, a passive ETF, to do just that.
Okay, so you're actually putting into action the opportunity you were talking about earlier. Okay, great.
Trying to. Yes.
Okay, and sorry, when does that ETF become available?
We're shooting for the end of this year. So we have a partnership with Bloomberg, and we are in the business of pitching this to issuers at this point in time. We've put it together, the methodology set. The alpha is super strong. The back testing, of course, super strong. And we are, you know, we're looking for issuer partners to take this to market.
All right, great. Well, look, David, we'll have you back on the program again in the future. And when this launches, you can, you know, we'll have you back on when it does, and you can tell folks exactly where to go to take part of it if they're interested. All right. So I promised I'd get back to this at the end of the conversation. For folks that have really enjoyed this conversation, whether they're interested in your zombie list, whether they're interested in some of these companies and sectors that you think are due to benefit from, you know, the positive trends we just talked about, or whether they want to learn a little bit more about the ETF, where should they go?
Go to newconstructs.com. There you can sign up for webinars where we, you know, I regularly engage with our client and audience, client base and audience around kind of what it is we do and take questions. We believe we've got a better mousetrap for getting to the truth about profits and earnings. And we're very transparent about that because we can be. Everything is sourced right back to the original filing. You can follow us on Twitter or on at New Constructs. We also have put together what we call our Society of Intelligent Investors. You can go to our website and find ways to sign up for that, where we engage with our clients and audience very directly around questions around reverse discounted cash flow analysis, as well as footnotes analysis and what we're finding in footnotes and how much value we believe we're adding for our clients in terms of going through these footnotes at scale for thousands of companies. We'd like to talk about what it is we're doing because we believe that educating people as to sort of how we do things also helps them understand our value proposition. So it's a win-win for this kind of technology for more people to understand what's out there.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. And that's, you know, totally aligned with the whole mission here at Wealthion, right? And we just figure by creating a more financially literate populace that everything benefits. People make smarter investing decisions, that capital goes to the right type of places. Investors benefit from more positive returns. It just creates a virtuous cycle. So glad to hear that you're an active player in that mission as well. All right. Well, folks, look, in wrapping up here, I just want to underscore, a lot of the risks that David and I talked about, both with the zombie companies, but to the larger economy, especially if the Fed is unable to thread the needle gracefully, and we have some bigger dislocations that may happen, but also just underscoring too the importance of active investing, like really doing your detective work in picking a good company and knowing why you own it, and then monitoring that closely while your capital is invested in it. These are all reasons why we highly recommend on this channel that people work under the guidance of a good seasoned professional financial advisor who can create a personalized portfolio plan for you, given your particular needs, risk tolerance, and goals. If you've got one who fits that background, but also takes into account all the things that we've talked about here, that Dave and I have talked about, great, stick with them. They are actually very rare. But if you don't have one, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. To go do that, just fill out the short form at wealthion.com. These consultations are totally free. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service they offer to help people navigate what may be coming as gracefully and prudently as possible. And if you've enjoyed this conversation with David, would like to see him come back on and update us on where things are in the zombie world in a quarter or so, please vote for that by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. David, it's been great. Thanks so much for coming back on the program, for giving us so much of your time, and for not just talking about the zombies, but telling us too where you see, you know, some of the diamonds in the rough in the markets these days.
Thank you, Adam. It's been great being with you. And I love how our philosophies and goals are aligned.
Great. Hey, and good luck with the ETF. I can't wait to hear how that works out for you. Thanks so much again, David. Everyone else, thanks so much for watching.